From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. California numbers suggest keeping your distance could be slowing the spread of coronavirus. How rebranding from social to physical distancing might make them even better. Plus, a college professor and a comedian share a lot in common. Both perform for a crowd whose attention they're trying to keep. Orange County native Amy Silverberg does both jobs. We'll hear what she's doing while work in both is impossible to find. It's coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. We got a packed show, so let's get right into it. In a press conference a little over an hour ago, Governor Gavin Newsom unveiled more relief for Californians during the pandemic, including an initiative to increase wellness checks for the state's 5.3 million seniors.
We have to do it in a way that not only just checks in on someone to see how they're feeling, but be able to deliver something on the back end, not just a meal or medical supplies. And that's why we've created a hotline for people across the state that will guide them to more substantively deliver on the needs of the individual they're contacting.
That hotline number is 833-544-2374. Again, that's 833-544-2374. Newsom also announced an executive order for small businesses offering a 90-day extension on state taxes. Oh, and remember yesterday when he issued a call for medical professionals, retirees, and students? Well, over 25,000 Californians responded. Now, if you're one of them, please let us know. Tweet us at Take Two. That's at Take Two. More are needed, though the governor said if you'd like to take part in that, you can head over to healthcorps.california.gov. That's healthcorps.ca.gov. First, though, the power of physical distancing. Today, Californians woke up to some pretty hopeful news. Our efforts to stay 6 feet apart from one another may have helped the state slow the spread of the coronavirus. Yeah, if you look at the chart we have up on our website, take2.org, California is trending better than New York or New Jersey in terms of the increase in cases. Yeah, it's a positive, but it's only one snapshot of this particular moment in time. So for more on how to read this data now and what this means for our future, we have Jeremy Green. He's a professor of medicine and history of medicine at Johns Hopkins University, which also put together that graph that I mentioned earlier. Jeremy, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me here today.
Sure. Now, okay, give us a sense of where California is now in terms of cases and what we're seeing with the numbers.
Well, I mean, I think the numbers are still going up. As the governor announced today that the number of hospitalized cases have doubled in the last 2 days, the number of ICU cases have tripled. Statewide figures, as the last time I've checked the Hopkins map, which, like many of your listeners, I've been obsessively refreshing on computer, are still substantial. There's nearly 400 in San Francisco and more than 2,500 in Los Angeles. So they're still going up. I think that the ray of hope that was being discussed is that they're going up perhaps slower than models had suggested, which many would like to cautiously attribute to the effectiveness of social distancing, or what some call physical distancing policies, that were put in effect by city and state leaders.
And we're looking for any ray of hope, Jeremy. I mean, whatever is anywhere near positive, we would love to just wrap our arms around it. But is it just that, as you mentioned, is it just that we're staying more away from each other right now than we ever have been?
Well, I think that's the best. It's the best maneuver we have, honestly. The data for this comes from a historical study done looking at the 1918-1919 influenza pandemic, more than 100 years ago, in which there was no pharmaceutical intervention for this deadly flu. There was no vaccine available at the time. And yet different cities employed these social distancing metrics at different rates and produced a heterogeneous, a different mortality and morbidity rate. So a city like St. Louis, which implemented early, layered, and sustained forms of school closings, public gathering bans, and other social distancing measures, had three times fewer deaths for the influenza than a city like Pittsburgh, which did them piecemeal, slower, and shorter. So what we would really hope right now is not to reproduce that kind of natural experiment in which we see heterogeneity. We would like to see every city bending and flattening the curve.
You mentioned Pittsburgh. I also heard Philadelphia, too, didn't really take it that seriously back then, and they suffered some pretty bad losses.
Yeah, the Philadelphia story is horrific, and compounded by a massive war bond parade taking place in the city that city officials declined to cancel. And it's really hard to recapture an image of just how much death, let alone overwhelming medical institutions, the city had to face at that point. And there are many reasons why the current situation is different from the pandemic of 1918-1919. But one of them that we would hope is different is that all American cities now could learn the lessons that were learned then piecemeal and actually work together to bend this curve.
So at least does it seem like we are learning a bit from the past?
So, again, as a historian, we're only going to know in the future, looking back, whether the flattening that we're talking about today represents the real inflection point in this S-shaped logistic curve where the plateau truly begins, or whether it's just a blip and we're putting our hopes on a blip. But I think either way, it's crucial, as the governor announced today, not to take this as any evidence of loosening. And it's very important to extend these measures, which are really the only effective measures we have at this point.
Talking to Jeremy Green, professor of medicine and history of medicine at Johns Hopkins University. Now, one of the questions, Jeremy, we've been getting a lot from listeners is about numbers and tracking. How is this increase in cases being tracked?
Well, I think the great challenge for epidemiologists at this moment in time is to know anything like a denominator. In other words, we have done such a delayed and partial and hesitant form of unfolding screening for our population that we really have no idea how many people are truly infected. This is another difference between coronavirus and influenza. Influenza, like many classic epidemics, presents with a clear set of symptoms. You know if someone's got influenza or not. Coronavirus, we know most people have little if no symptoms. Many have mild symptoms. The course takes so much longer to develop. And so we are really operating from behind in terms of any sense of the scope of how many people really have this infection. And that makes it really hard to know what to make of these numbers because we are only doing screening on a tiny portion of the people that we know to truly have the disease.
So then when it comes to modeling, when we see models come out, I ask this, Jeremy, because I'm a big fan of Nate Silver's blog, 538, for a lot of sports reasons. Yeah. But that's what they do all day long. In politics, whatever, they do modeling. But they refuse to put a model in place for coronavirus because it's too hard to trust anything this early. Does modeling even matter right now?
Well, I think we have to believe that modeling matters because we need to find a means upon which we can act in the present to have a ability to make a difference in the future. It's just that the models have a tremendous amount of noise in them and a tremendous amount of unpredictability. It's kind of like listeners will be familiar with the hurricane charts that we produce. And right around where the hurricane is, it's pretty easy to tell where we think it's going to go. But the further out you get, the murkier it is. And will it hit this side of Florida or that side of Florida? And so in this case, modeling is essential because we need to prepare ourselves for the worst. And the worst, again, for everybody who has seen what was a bit of historical arcana about 4 weeks ago, right, this idea of flattening the curve of that sharp peak versus the slower curve. And really that represents the historical evidence from what happened in, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, which is that sharp spike, versus what happened in St. Louis, which is that slower curve. So part of what modeling does is it helps us reshape our public health institutions, our healthcare institutions, to mobilize healthcare professionals like myself. Most of my medical practice has been outpatient, and yet many of us are being remobilized for inpatient service right now. Hospital floors are turning into ICUs. Field hospitals are being set up. This allows us to prepare so that when the surge comes, because all of the good news of today does not mean the surge isn't coming, but when the surge comes, we can be as prepared as possible to prevent those deaths that could be prevented by appropriate access to medical technology.
Jeremy, I understand what you say when you're saying don't let your guard down, that this is just right now a point in time, and it's nice and positive, but we should not let our guard down. Governor Newsom basically said the same thing today, that we should continue keeping our distance from each other. But I'm wondering, will there be a point where we can look at this data and feel confident about it, feel really good about where we're going?
We would all love that point where we feel good. Yeah. I think I come back to this challenge of just how late we are in the game of unfolding a true surveillance, a comprehensive surveillance system. If we were South Korea, we could talk much more comfortably about how to reach that point, because South Korea immediately mobilized a robust testing mechanism that gave them a much more credible version of what the denominator is, how many people are really affected versus how many people are coming into hospitals. We're still nowhere near this. I, as an outpatient practitioner, was nowhere close to being able to order a COVID test for my patients. And so even though we are ramping up testing and we are able to broaden the criteria for which we test people, and hopefully we'll soon be able to do antibody screening to see who has been exposed. For the many, many people who had minor symptoms and think they may have been exposed and can now perhaps have some degree of confidence that they could do more work. But we're not there yet. So my biggest hope would be for a robust deployment of a screening test for COVID screening and for antibody screening so we could get a better view of the epidemiologic reality that we're facing.
Jeremy Green is professor of medicine and history of medicine at Johns Hopkins University. Jeremy, thanks for giving it to us straight.
No, thank you so much.
All right, you may have noticed that I used the term physical distancing in my last chat instead of social distancing. Just when we've all gotten used to that latter term, the World Health Organization and some other public officials have started urging us to change that to physical distancing. Well, there's one professor whose life story explains why that distinction is so important. Professor Daniel Aldrich is a director of the Security and Resilience Program at Northeastern University in Boston. Professor Aldrich, thanks for joining us on Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
What was your first reaction when the coronavirus pandemic grew and you heard the media and public officials stressing the need for, quote, social distancing?
I thought it was the exact wrong term to use right now. We definitely need physical distancing. We need that space between us. But at the same time, those social ties are exactly what will get us out of this process. We need them for emotional support, for resources, for information. So if anyone listening really believed the term social distancing meant cutting off ties or hunkering down or not helping someone else, that'd be a real problem for society.
Yeah, and to put the point on it, the expectation is while we should stay apart from each other, we still can connect socially on the phone, FaceTime, or maybe even 6 feet away from your neighbor's hedge, right? I mean, that's the kind of the thing. When we saw social distancing and then we saw spring breakers in Florida still be social with each other, I think maybe the importance of the term got a little muddy.
Exactly. The thing is, even with a note or a knock on a window, we can still connect with someone who we can't touch or hug or you know, embrace physically. We're able to help in many ways. You know, my wife's been delivering vegetables to people here in the community who need help. We've been dropping off notes and assistance to people who need toilet paper or other things. You can walk a dog or offer someone money for babysitting. All things you can do without having that physical connection. So we have so many things now. We have Nextdoor. We have radio waves, all kinds of ways to connect we couldn't before. So it's important to recognize that we shouldn't be dropping those connections that we have, whether it's a church or a mosque or synagogue, whether it's, you know, exercising with a group, whatever we're doing that we did before. Those are the activities that keep us normal and keep us connected in these kind of shocks and crises.
Now, Professor, you have a really dramatic example from your own life that illustrates how social connections, perhaps even in the crisis, can really save lives. Can you share that story?
Sure. Back in 2005, my wife and I moved down to New Orleans in the summer, and we had 6 really good weeks there, met a few people, and then we ignored all the warnings as Hurricane Katrina got closer and closer. We didn't evacuate, we didn't leave, we didn't pack up, until just a few hours before landfall, one of our neighbors came over to our house, Kathy, and told us, you know, you guys think you'll be okay, really get out of there. At the time, we had 2 small kids who couldn't swim. We would be trapped in a 1-story apartment, and it would have been a big problem for us if we'd been there. So I saw early on in my career how important trusted neighbors, people that you know, family, friends, those people are so important in these moments of crisis.
So since Katrina, then, you've gone on to study how communities have endured natural disasters, from Puerto Rico to Japan to the Camp Fire up in Northern California. Professor, what have you learned?
Yeah, in all those situations across time and space, the most important resources that we have don't come from the federal government or the local government. They don't come from money or insurance. The real things that drive us to help us survive and thrive come from our networks. You know, whether it's an elderly person, for example, in Japan, 9 years ago during the triple disasters, when a massive earthquake, tsunami, and meltdowns happened at the same time, all the people that we talked to that did well, everyone who survived and got out, they had friends and neighbors helping them physically, emotionally, and in terms of resources. Same thing in terms of the Paradise fires. People who were able to get out had warnings ahead of time. In New Orleans as well, where one example, but many of our colleagues I talked to, they had networks that helped them find jobs, new places to live, places for their kids who were just about to enter school. So in many, so many ways, those daily resources that we have, people that we talk to, friends, friends of friends, networks, religious organizations, those play a huge role during these crises when oftentimes we can't get to the normal places. We can't get to kindergartens. Right now, some of us can't get out to go food shopping. Those neighbors are really important.
We're talking to Professor Daniel Aldrich, Director of the Security and Resilience Program at Northeastern University in Boston. Now, there are some experts who say that changing the term from social distancing could get confusing for people and that, people, get it. So what do you say to that when it comes to changing it from social to physical distancing?
You know, the reality is, I think the term social distancing is just a little confusing. Physical distancing is much more concrete. It says you should keep your physical distance.
It's direct,
social
right? It's
direct,
putting it
right?
out there.
Nothing confusing. Social distancing is a term of art from epidemiology, which is great. And if people know what that means, more power to them. And if they can have that term in their mind while they still reach out to their neighbors, even better. But I think physical distancing makes it quite clear. The only thing that we're separating is the space between us. We're not cutting off those ties. We're not stopping our prayers. We're not stopping connections to people nearby or our assistance to the elderly and the needy. If we recognize, through whatever term we want to use, that our connections to people will be what gets us through this, that's fine with me.
And I'll admit, Daniel, I mean, I said the word social distancing, for weeks now on the air here, just because that's what everyone said to say. But I never liked it because, yeah, when you say the word social, it kind of just makes it feel like, okay, that means we can all get together. And it felt weird to do it. I did it, but now I'm not going to do it anymore, Daniel.
Great. Well, one more. You know, WHO just converted over. The Victorian government in Australia is going there. The Red Cross, a lot of organizations recognizing that, as this drags on, which may be weeks or months before we get back to normalcy, what's going to help us, feel that we're not alone in this, that if we had, for example, beforehand depression, if we had beforehand, domestic abuse, how will we help people recognize that we're still here for them? The more that we can do to emphasize, no, we're only standing 6 feet apart, but we can still help you out in so many other ways. That will be what really helps us move.
Professor Daniel Aldrich is the director of the Security and Resilience Program at Northeastern University in Boston, talking with us about why the phrase physical distancing is a lot better to use than social distancing. Daniel, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
All right, today is the last day of KPCC's spring fundraiser. Remember, we had to cancel our normal member drive in order to bring you very important coronavirus coverage. But as always, we rely on you, our biggest source of funding. And your support right now, we need more than ever before. There are still $15,000 left in matching funds from John and Mary Too, which means your donation today will be matched dollar for dollar. So please, please give right now at kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org. Or give us a call, 866-888-5722. That's 866-888-5722. More Take Two coming right up.
And when the broken-hearted people living in this world agree, there will be an answer. Let it be. For though we may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see.
There will be an answer.
Let it be. Let it be.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. With California schools out until May 1st, and actually probably longer, some parents may be struggling to both work and care for young children at home. The federal government has provided some relief in its recently passed stimulus package, but Lingling Chang says it does not go far enough. She's a Republican state senator from Diamond Bar and has just introduced new legislation she says would cover the gaps for families in that stimulus bill. Senator Chang is here with us to explain. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much.
Now, let's give an overview of what the federal government will provide. Families that need to care of their children will be entitled to 12 weeks of leave and up to $200 each day as pay, up to $10,000 total. That's effective until the end of this calendar year. But you say, Senator, that that's not enough. So why?
Right. So we're talking about state-paid family leave right now. So right now, if we look at the federal government, so Californians who would not qualify under the Federal Leave Act would be parents who work for an employer with 500-plus employees, some parents who work for an employer with fewer than 50 employees, any parent with children displaced from school longer than 3 months, and I believe that this is definitely going to be longer, and any parent with children displaced from school after December 2020, you know, in the event that COVID-19 surges after that. But for me, it doesn't make sense to cover half the population. We are in a crisis, and California needs to step up and fill these gaps.
Yeah, so those gaps are the ones that you're looking to fill there. Now, walking through your proposal, it would extend who's eligible. In the federal law, people can qualify if they work for companies, as you mentioned, with more than 500 employees and in some cases fewer than 50. Your bill would now include everyone in between. Why include everyone in between? Is it one of those things where, as you said, it's going to extend a lot further than anyone even dreams of, so everyone has to get covered now?
Right, because this is unprecedented. You know, COVID-19 is definitely unprecedented, and parents are now at home having to take care of their kids, and I think that we need to cover those folks as well, as we've been hearing from a lot of parents who are limiting their meals per day to save money, you know, or they're making sure that their children have enough food. So, you know, this extraordinary moment calls for extraordinary responses, and we need to use every tool we have right now.
I've heard some parents not eating and just saving their meals for their kids.
I mean, right.
Yeah, that's serious stuff. Now, your bill would go on beyond 12 weeks. Why is that part of your proposal?
Because we just don't know how long COVID-19 is going to last. And so it's really important to provide coverage.
Now, why do you think that these state coverages will be necessary?
As we've seen right now, we need some relief for parents who have to be at home. And as I'm hearing from a lot of parents in my district, it's really important for them. You know, they're struggling if they can't go to work, you know, because their kids are at home. I think this is something that needs to happen for our families here in California.
We're talking to Lingling Chang, Republican state senator from Diamond Bar. Now, last week, we talked about how California had this rainy day fund, close to $21 billion, and now it's rapidly draining. So where could the money for your measure come from?
It will come from the general fund.
It will come. Okay. That's all of it is going to come from there.
Right.
Okay, so then what's the timeline for this to get heard in the legislature when, frankly, so many parts of government are shut down right now? How quickly could all of this be passed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, before state lawmakers adjourned for the emergency break, we did pass a key resolution outlining rules to allow us to take up bills and vote remotely. We're supposed to return April 12th, but we just don't know right now if that's even possible. So we may need to take advantage of the remote voting if this continues.
How much bipartisan support have you gleaned from this so far? I mean, I know that it's just in the early stages, but I'm wondering if this has both Republicans and Democrats on board.
Oh, it should. I mean, the emergency package that we passed in the legislature, that was bipartisan to allow the governor to take action. So I believe that this should also gain bipartisan support as well.
Lingling Chang, Republican state senator from Diamond Bar. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
While most of Southern California is now working from home, it's important to note that not everyone can. Our columnist Eric Galindo spoke with one warehouse worker risking his health to maintain supply lines for hospitals, grocery stores, and just about everyone else. He brings us this profile.
The man cries sometimes on his way to work. That's when all the pressure gets to him. It's pretty overwhelming at times, he told me recently over the phone on his drive to work. I could hear the road in the background, and I kind of missed traffic briefly. We're talking on the phone on the same morning that the U.S. Senate passed a $2 trillion stimulus package to bail out corporations and attempt to stem unprecedented unemployment. Meanwhile, the U.S. has become the worldwide leader in confirmed coronavirus cases. It's harrowing news, and I suddenly can't imagine what it's like to be driving to work anymore. I'm scared, he said, but honestly, I need this job, and I don't really have any other options. He's too scared to share his name publicly, afraid of being fired for speaking out. Normally, we insist people use their real full names, but we aren't in normal times, so I'll call him Jack, just for the purpose of telling his story. Jack is a father, a husband, a friend, and among the thousands of warehouse workers that are putting in long hours at great risk to their health so that we are safer from COVID-19. They maintain the supply lines for hospitals, grocery stores, and other essential businesses. The war might be existential, but the front line is real. I'm trying to do everything I can so that we are all safe, but I can't, Jack said, because the we is a lot of people operating in tight conditions. Jack works in a packed warehouse with hundreds of others moving day and night to keep up with the highest demand in recent memory. There aren't enough employees to handle it, but also no room or time to make sure everyone is standing 6 feet apart. The workers share a tiny bathroom and a few empty hand sanitizer stations. The crazy part is that the Fortune 500 company he works for packages and sells millions of dollars in cleaning supplies like face masks and hand sanitizer. Jack didn't want to tell me which one it is. They're all the same anyway, he said. I don't know if they weren't prepared or if it was just greed, but I'm not really sure why they're not taking it seriously, Jack said. Every day I leave the house, I know I'm more at risk, especially because I know they're not taking all the precautions there. The long hours, the short staff, the stress of working during the pandemic takes a physical toll on the immune system. Tired, sleep-deprived workers are more susceptible to infection. And not being able to wash and clean your hands properly can spread coronavirus to these packages that are being shipped to hospitals and everywhere else. If you don't worry about production now, you won't worry about production later, because there won't be any production, Jack said. He's tried taking his concerns to his managers, but Jack said they keep telling him there's nothing to worry about and that the flu kills more people. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles County Department of Health has said that the mortality rate for COVID-19 is higher than the flu. It's more contagious too, and more capable of knocking out an entire close-quartered group of people at once. And I know from talking to my shift manager, they've never seen profit margins this high, Jack said. He was telling me, and he was happy about it. That's a hell of a thing to hear when you're complaining about working conditions. You start to feel like not only do they not care about your safety in a way, but like they don't care about you as a human being, Jack said. You know, I've been anti-capitalist philosophically for a while, but I never thought I would ever be personally hurt by actual capitalism. Jack told me he's even tried reaching out to corporate headquarters for help or even peace of mind. My manager came up to me yesterday and told me, you know, they're only going to do the legally required minimum, right? I probably cried 3 times this week, Jack said, just because it kind of F's with you to feel that hopeless. He's right. It does.
Eric Galindo chronicles life in Los Angeles for LAist in his column Mis Angeles. And you can read this column and more by Eric on our website. That's LAist.com, LAIST.com. His story was produced by Austin Cross. Now for another mid-show moment of Zen. With so much going on these days, it can be hard to find a little peace of mind. So as often as possible, we're going to bring you some encouraging words from members of our community to help you slow down, take a breath and find peace. Today, we bring you Rabbi Susan Goldberg of Nefesh Shabbat in East L.A., reading a reflection on disappointment written by poet David White.
Disappointment is inescapable but necessary. A misunderstood mercy, and when approached properly, an agency for transformation, and the hidden underground engine of trust and generosity in a human life. The attempt to create a life devoid of disappointment is the attempt to avoid the vulnerabilities that make the conversations of life real, moving, and lifelike. It is the attempt to avoid our own necessary and merciful heartbreak. To be disappointed is to reassess ourselves and our inner world, and to be called to the larger foundational reality that lies beyond any false self we had only projected upon the outer world. Disappointment is a friend to transformation, a call to both accuracy and generosity in the assessment of ourself and others, a test of sincerity and a catalyst of resilience. Disappointment is just the initial meeting with the frontier of an evolving life, an invitation to reality, which we expected to be one particular way and turns out to be another. Often something more difficult, more overwhelming, and strangely in the end, more rewarding.
All right, today is the last day of KPCC's Spring Fundraiser. Remember, we canceled our normal member drive because bringing you coronavirus coverage is way more important, and we wanted to make sure that we had all the time in the world to do that. But we still rely on your support. We still need your support, especially now more than ever before. There are $13,000 left in matching funds from John and Mary Too, which means your donation right now, whatever you give, will be matched dollar for dollar. Your dollar stretches further now than ever before. So your impact on KPCC is doubled. So please, please give right now. KPCC.org. That's KPCC.org. Or give us a call. 866-888-5722. That's 866-888-5722. More Take Two coming up.
A train coming. Don't need no baggage. You just get on board. All we need is faith to hear the diesel humming. Don't need no ticket. We'll just thank the Lord.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It was expected, but today the Trump administration finalized a rollback on Obama-era vehicle mileage standards, weakening one of the country's largest efforts to combat climate change. Attorney General Javier Becerra spoke out against the move this morning and called the new standards unacceptable and a violation of the law.
It contravenes the federal government statutes that these agencies are authorized to work under, the Energy Policy and Conservation Act and the Clean Air Act. And we believe that the federal government should be in the business of complying with the law rather than violating it.
The Attorney General also says they'll do whatever necessary to protect standards in California. The Trump administration argues the relaxed mileage will allow consumers to buy less fuel-efficient SUVs and make cars cheaper. But opponents say they'll spend more on fuel and the new standards will lead to dirtier air that will kill several hundred more Americans a year. The rollback sets mileage standards through 2026. All right, now to higher ed. California community college leaders say it's been a massive task in the last few weeks to prepare their faculty for online instruction. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez explains how one college did it and how staff are helping students who've put education on the back burner because of the current crisis.
On Friday, March 13th, Glendale College ordered all classes to start online the following Wednesday. It set aside Monday and Tuesday to train its 850 professors. Then it got the results of a faculty survey.
Half of them said we need more time, and about 15% said they didn't even think they'd be ready at the end of the week.
That's Roger Bowerman. He's president of the faculty union at Glendale College. It was bad news. Some professors had never used an online platform for assignments or tests. In an emergency meeting, faculty and administrators decided to clear the whole week for training. Only one day ended up being in person.
By Monday night, it became clear that the state was going to mandate social distancing. And so by Tuesday, we were already doing remote instruction.
Departments were divided up into groups that included at least one expert in distance education.
The English division created buddy systems so that people with skills were paired with people that needed help.
In a survey at the end of the training week, Bowerman says, 85% of faculty said they were ready to teach online. Kinesiology professor Erin Calderon was one of them.
I was able to get through and actually hold a lecture exactly the way I would in class. I would go through the slides. I would ask students if they had any questions. You know, we had discussions either verbally or over the typed chat.
But here's where the huge effort to train faculty to teach online meets the reality of whether students will stick with it. One of Calderon's students, Tom Dormer, appreciates all the effort she's making to teach online, but it's not what he signed up for.
I just learned better when I'm in a school setting. It's just something about actually being on the campus, you know, sitting down in class and getting the lesson and hands-on stuff and being able to ask the teacher right away, you know, right there to break it down.
Dormer needs this class to transfer to a four-year university in the fall, so he's highly motivated to make it work. For many other community college students, motivation won't be enough to overcome what this crisis is throwing at them. Lost jobs and many more hours during the day caring for family instead of studying. Molly Mercer is in touch with a lot of these students. She's a counselor at Glendale College.
I just think about, you know, parents, single parents who now their kids are at home and they're trying to go to school. How are they going to, you know, take their classes from home while they're trying to take care of their kids and teach their kids and feed their kids at home?
Those and other vulnerable students no longer have face-to-face counseling and other support that kept them in classes. Bowerman, who's teaching one history class this semester, said 10% of his students have withdrawn and another 10% are struggling to cope emotionally or have problems with technology.
What faculty are encouraged to do is try over the next couple of weeks to engage them. And if you can't engage them, if they seem to have disappeared, we're going to drop them from our classes so they don't get a fail.
Leaders of LA's nine community colleges, which enroll 142,000 students, gave faculty and students 2 weeks to prepare for online classes. Andra Hoffman is president of the board that oversees the colleges. She is worried about students dropping out. However, changes made by the state community college's chancellor allow students to receive excused withdrawals without hurting their academic record.
If they really just can't manage in this environment, they can drop the class, get their money back, and not be penalized.
Her faculty, she says, is coming up with multiple ways to connect students to learning, and campus counselors are working hard to reach students. The goal, she and others say, is to keep students on track to graduation or transfer, because a college degree will help them once this crisis is in the rearview mirror. Covering higher education, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
All right, you know that you rely on KPCC for a lot of things, especially a sense of community and fact-based news during these very uncertain and scary times. Now, your support right now helps KPCC and NPR keep being right here for you with the coronavirus coverage that you need and you rely on. Now, today is the last day, the absolute last day, to help us reach our spring fundraising goal. So please, please give right now, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by John and Mary too. But you got to call. You got to call 866-888-5722. That's 866-888-5722. Or log on to kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org. More Take Two coming up in just a bit. Stick around.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes, are calling, yeah, from glen to glen.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. If you're a stand-up comedy junkie, one benefit to California's stay-at-home order is that there's plenty of comedy to watch online and on streaming channels. And I've been noticing that while there's a long list of superstar women comics, Whitney Cummings, Tiffany Haddish, Nikki Glaser, Ali Wong, you're not going to see them among the highest paid comedians. Forbes 2019 top 10 list only has one, Amy Schumer, at number 7, and she's surrounded by a bunch of dudes. So mark me down as not surprised when I heard comedian Amy Silverberg tell this story.
I get stressed, you know, because I teach, I do stand-up. So lately I've been going to play poker alone at a casino in Inglewood, California, hanging by a thread, Hollywood Park Casino. Uh-huh. They redid it?
Yeah.
$6 pot stickers? Hell yeah. Okay. Anyway, I always meet weird old men there because there are no women. And I met a weird old man. He asked me what I did. I said, I'm a writer and a comedian. And he said, let me think if I can name a female comedian. So I was like, great. And then he said, have you ever heard of Lucille Ball?
Now, okay, so while that does sound like an answer you'd hear from some weird old guy at a casino, isn't that generally an unsurprising answer to that question? I mean, you could go back decades and you'd get that answer.
Lucille Ball, yeah, or Amy Schumer is one that most people have heard of. There's always like key comedians, two or three, that people always mention, and usually they're men. Amy's probably one of the few women that people mention.
Who are some of the women comedians working now that you'd like to see get more attention these days? Other than Amy Silverberg, I know you'd love to get more attention.
Oh my gosh, I mean, there are just so many good female comedians in LA. I love Deborah DiGiovanni. She's Canadian, if it matters, but she lives in LA. I love Blair Saki. I love Rachel Mack is someone that I ran a show with for 5 years. God, I have so many. I can just keep listing them.
And Amy Silver. I'll put your name in there at the end there. Now, you're both a comedian and a teacher. You teach creative writing and literature at USC. First, how has the coronavirus pandemic affected that work?
Oh, man. I mean, it's greatly affected it. My students were supposed to turn in the midterm during when quarantine was first happening, and they of course were just so panicked, and my party line was pretty much just like, don't worry you guys, your health and this national crisis is most important. If you turn the midterm in late, you won't be penalized, we'll figure out a way. My students, it was a class about empathy in literature, that was what it was called, which seems now very timely.
Yeah.
Well, my students are writing essays about sort of how they feel right now in quarantine and being an individual in the collective that's so all going through this together, and the panic and the anxiety. And I just keep telling them, don't worry about your grade. Of all things now, that's not the thing to worry about.
Now, for anyone wondering, okay, so comedian and USC professor. So how do you square the two? Aren't they both performances in a way? You're out in front of people performing.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think about that a lot. I had started writing before I started doing stand-up, and then I got an MFA, which is a master's in fine arts in creative writing, and then I thought, well, I'll just keep going to school. I'll get a PhD too, because I needed someone to pay me to write. But I never really set out to be a professor. That had never been my dream. It was always to be a writer. And then I started doing stand-up about 5 years ago, which was sort of like a secret longing that I had, and for whatever reason was harder for me to admit to everyone that I really wanted to be on stage. And then when I started teaching, I realized how close it was to stand up and how much I liked it. And similar to stand up, it's choosing your words carefully. It's trying to keep them engaged. It's also making them laugh. When a student looks away at his phone, I'm reminded of somebody at a stand up show looking away at their phone. It's different, of course, but that idea of how do I keep somebody's attention engaged, and how do I say something in a way that makes them think, oh yeah, I knew that, but I couldn't have said it better myself, that kind of recognition, which is also the same as when you read a great sentence in a novel and you think, oh wow, I couldn't have said it better myself. The same as when you hear a great joke and you think, oh wow, yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself.
We're talking with comedian and USC writing professor Amy Silverberg.
I look young, so the female students always email me really familiarly in like lowercase letters. One of my students emailed me. She goes, "Dear Amy, I won't be coming to class today. I took the morning after pill and I don't feel well. Dot, dot, dot. You know how it is."
Now, most comedians grow up as class clowns. Amy, I'm wondering, as a teacher, as a professor, do you have to shove the clown down when you're in front of your students?
I mean, I was definitely a class clown also growing up. In fact, I was voted class clown in high school. Yeah, you know, I love a class clown in my classes. I love somebody who has a well-timed comment for the class that's not trying to undermine the flow of the class. But I do. Every now and then I'll be like, I'll make a few comments and I'll say to myself, Amy, it's not the Amy show. It's not about you. The impulse in me to make people laugh is almost a compulsion that I have to pay attention to sometimes.
Amy, I think with everything going on this year with coronavirus, I think it's one of those things where you wonder if comedy will ever be the same. I know now after 9/11, maybe people didn't want to laugh right away. But when this is all over, I'm wondering if you've got something that maybe you're working on that we'll see in your act when coronavirus is finally something that we can all handle.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will. Stand-up will be strange for a while after. I've talked to a lot of friends who are like, do you think we'll all have the same sort of quarantine jokes, or we'll all be so tired of talking about the same thing, or will the shared experience help in some way? And I think probably all of that stuff will be true. I'm a big fan of Twitter, and I like writing jokes on Twitter, and I want to repeat a tweet I loved by Blair Saki. She said that this is like the roaring 20s for dogs. They've never had a better time. And I think good jokes about this can make you feel less alone or make you feel understood. I think all of the above will be true. Stand-up will be pretty strange, but it will be pretty interesting too.
What about interacting with fans? I mean, you're close to them. They're looking right at you. Maybe after a show, they want a selfie. Is that something that you think you might have to rethink?
I mean, that's a great question. I'm wondering, I'm wondering if this is going to have a hard end date, or if there's going to be a long snail trail of sort of people still kind of afraid to go out to shows, or is everybody just going to be so thrilled to be out of their apartments and at shows, or should we all be a little safer? I'm not germophobic in any way. I am, however, a type 1 diabetic, so I don't know. I can't say. I'm usually pretty, I don't think twice about shaking someone's hand, but maybe after this, I'll be a little bit more careful.
All right. Now, every comedian I've talked with gets the same final question, and it's in the form of a clip from History of the World Part 1. It's Mel Brooks defining what a comedian means to society.
Occupation, stand-up philosopher. What?
Stand-up philosophers. I coalesce the vapor of human experience into a viable and logical comprehension.
Oh, a bullshit artist.
All right, Amy Silverberg, stand-up philosopher, for people searching for viable, logical comprehension about what's going on in the world with coronavirus, what would you offer them?
I mean, my first reaction is, oh, they should talk to a scientist or a virologist, not me. I will say that the only thing that seems to soothe me during this time is reading good novels. I think that's the thing that can calm you most at this time.
That's comedian Amy Silverberg. Amy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You heard Amy Silverberg mention that her students are studying empathy in literature and writing about their feelings right now in quarantine. Well, we always want to know how you're feeling throughout all of this, whether you're a student, a parent, an adult, a teenager, a healthcare worker, or a grocery store worker. So please share your story with us. There are a few ways to get in touch with the team here at Take Two. You can email us at take2show@kpcc.org. You can also tweet us at Take Two. We're also on Facebook, or just call us 626-583-5281 and leave us a message. Tell us your name and how you're doing, and we'll aim to get your story on the air. Again, that number is 626-583-5281. And thanks for sharing your story and your time with us.